Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on this momentous day. My name is David Myers, and I have the privilege of serving as the inaugural director of the Luskin Center for History and Policy. We're really delighted to be hosting this event on gentrification and its discontents, which looks at the past and present and perhaps even future of the phenomenon of gentrification. You have to give it to us. We really know how to pick dates. I remember writing my friend Zev Yaroslavsky several weeks ago after someone offered me tickets to Game 7 of the World Series and saying, what do you think the likelihood will be of our event, long scheduled, taking place on this day? And I can't remember what he said, but none of us thought it to be a realistic proposition. The odds were against it, and he's here too. And I'm pleased to tell you that we will all be out by 5:20 this afternoon. Game 7 of a World Series featuring the hometown team may be the best guarantee that I can think of ensuring that long-winded academic speeches be curtailed. Now we're going to test that proposition. I have just a couple of brief opening remarks to make. First, the new Luskin Center for History and Policy. It's really an innovative experiment in bringing history into conversation with contemporary issues of relevance, and in fact, in conversation with the process of policy formation. We do that by encouraging a new culture of learning in historical education amongst our students as well as faculty by supporting research grants, teaching of new courses, public events such as this one, which this is the first public event of a series of events over the course of the academic year, and of the promotion of historically informed policy research. We want to really produce work that has historical depth and perspective and eventuates in actual policy guidelines and directives. Now, this idea, innovative as it is, really owes much to the inspiration and generosity of our friends Meyer and Rini Luskin, who I think right now are on a plane to China with the UCLA Foundation and expressed their regrets at not being here. Meyer in particular has long understood the salutary effects, the benefits of historical perspective in his own business career, as well as for society at large. And he has been cooking up some version of this idea for more than a decade and a half. And we're really delighted to be able to bring to life the vision that he first articulated about 15 years ago. It seems also appropriate that we're going to be touching upon Boyle Heights in our discussion of gentrification, because Meyer himself was raised in Boyle Heights. As we know, it has been a flashpoint of tension in recent months and over the past year. I remember really catching wind of it in my own consciousness when I read Steve Lopez's article from, I think, July 22nd of 2017 about the dispute surrounding the coffee house in Boyle Heights. We know well that gentrification is a central issue in Boyle Heights, but not exclusively there. It has a long history in Los Angeles. And in fact, on this occasion, it might be helpful to recall that there were issues surrounding what we might call gentrification in a place called Chavez Ravine, which is to say that piece of land was home over the course of the first half of the 20th century, to at least three notable communities of Mexican Americans, La Loma, Palo Verde, and Bishop. And beginning in the late 40s, and more particularly in the early 1950s, tensions arose with the city as well as with developers who saw the potential to grow that area into usages other than what it was at the time. And thus broke out the decade-long Battle of Chavez Ravine around 1951 to 1961, pitting the residents of those communities against the city and developers. Now, this, I think, reveals, others may be planning to talk about, and I've exhausted the limits of my knowledge on the Battle of Chavez Ravine. But what is important is it seems to reveal the complexity of the phenomenon of gentrification that we want to try to unpack. We're talking about what has become a revered icon in this city, and in fact, a huge economic engine. And yet, those data points belie its controversial origins. I'm not here to justify or celebrate eminent domain or the displacement of the local residents of Chavez Ravine, far from it, but rather to highlight the tension, the persistent tension between economic growth and neighborhood integrity that often arises in battles of gentrification. The good news is we have a wonderful panel to help us unpack the phenomenon, comprised of historians, journalists, and a development professional. I want to just say a couple of very brief concluding remarks. First, I'd like to thank the people who made this day's event possible: the Luskin Center coordinator, Ann Major, our graduate student fellows, Peter Chesney and Lindsay King, and of course, the indefatigable Peter Evans and his team from Social Science Development. Thank you very much for your work. Peter and Lindsay, can you raise your hands? Peter and Lindsay, our graduate student fellows, are planning to develop a graduate student research project on the topic of gentrification in Boyle Heights. It aims at understanding multiple perspectives on the issue, as well as specific policy objectives. If you're a graduate student and interested in collaborating or learning more, please see Peter and Lindsay after this session. And by the way, there will be, for anyone desirous of lingering after the panel, a reception outside. I'll see you for a brief spell there before I dash off. But now I'd like to hand things over to Rena Palta, who's reporting at KPCC on housing, homelessness, and the social safety net I found so very instructive over recent months.
Thank you so much.
Rena.
Thanks. Yeah, come on up. I'll let you guys get settled.
Thank you.
Cecilia.
Eric.
So let me just introduce the panelists here. We have Eric Avila, a professor of Chicano Studies and Urban Planning at UCLA, and the author of two books on the history of Los Angeles. Cecilia Estolano is co-CEO and co-founder of Estolano Lazar Perez Advisors and an expert in sustainable economic development and urban revitalization. Steve Lopez is a California native who has been an LA Times columnist since 2001. I'm not going to list all of his awards because they'll start making me feel bad. And we have Abel Valenzuela Jr., a professor of Chicano Studies and Urban Planning and director of UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. So thank you guys all for coming. So just to start real basic, I was hoping that the two planning experts here could talk a little bit about why this city looks like it does. This is a strange city by many accounts. How did LA come to look like it does now?
I would say the streetcars, the automobile, the geography, you know, the mountains, the plains, the valleys, I think delineated the patterns of settlement. So you can think of very technological factors that shaped the pattern of development in Los Angeles. I think you could also think about ideological factors, you know, the idea of the suburban family home, the nuclear family, suburban tract housing developments. You know, I think all of these factors played into a very 20th century version of the American city that became L.A.
I would add... processes by the state, including the role of nascent planning boards as well as city governments that were trying to figure out how to make our city work. I would also think about some of the development of neighborhoods and how they were isolated, in part because of both the infrastructure and natural environment, but for other purposes that would would facilitate a process of settlement for different sorts of others in Los Angeles, including Native peoples, for example, but also immigrants of different backgrounds. I think the early development of our city was very key in terms of trying to designate certain neighborhoods through different sorts of deeds and processes that resulted in very distinct neighborhoods that are niched by racial and ethnic concentrations.
And I should add, if you guys have anything.
Yeah, I'm also a planning expert. I'm a graduate of our planning program here. Abel's being really nice about it, but we could also talk about redlining, what we can call racial covenants, which just really formed a lot of the geography, the spatial distribution or concentration of certain communities in Los Angeles. It's baked into our DNA. I think, Eric, you're right, the geography, the natural geography of the mountains and the, we do have rivers here in the valleys, a part of it. But to get to kind of the starting point, you can't forget the baked-in racialization and the segregation that came in with redlining and racial covenants. Steve, want anything else?
What's the question?
What do we look like we do?
Basically, why is L.A. so weird? It just doesn't look like any other city.
But isn't that one of the most wonderful things about it? I'm not from here, and I'm still trying to figure this place out. And I think what I like best about L.A. is that you can never really figure it out. I'm from Northern California, the San Francisco area. I'd spent a lot of time in Philadelphia and living in New York City. When I first started writing a column here, I got an email one day from a guy talking about my column, and I said, so where do you live? And he said, New York City. And I said, okay, so where are you right now? He said, I'm at Langer's Deli. And I said, so why are you so interested, and why are you interested in L.A.? And he said, because New York knows what it wants to be. It already grew up. L.A. is still trying to figure it out, and it's so dynamic because of it, and it's constantly changing. And there are all of these forces, so many great riches, so many huge challenges, and those move in waves through neighborhoods. And I love getting out there and writing about that, and the material is just endless. It's constantly remaking itself, and maybe that's why it seems kind of wild and unformed. It's just very interesting to me.
So I think that leads to the next question, which is how wild has it actually been in terms of how growth has happened here? Has it been deliberate forces that have shaped how growth has happened here, or is it just sort of ad hoc and sporadic?
Los Angeles is a town based on real estate speculation. And Eric mentioned one of the first things he said that shapes our geography and the way we are today. He mentioned the streetcar. And people often think, oh, they say L.A. is sprawling because of the freeways. Actually, L.A. is sprawling because of the streetcars. The streetcars were created to create value to the land that developers had purchased in advance and wanted to make sure that the streetcar extended out to their land so that people would buy it and create these garden communities. So you could have a garden in your backyard, unlike places in the East Coast, congested cities, and you could get around really easily on the streetcar. Streetcar created this dispersed development pattern, which is pretty amazing, right? But what was it based on? It wasn't mobility. It was real estate speculation, right? Wilshire Boulevard. Wilshire bought a lot of land and wanted to make sure it was valuable. Huntington. He made sure we had a port that was down where it is today because he had those rail lines. So L.A. has always been controlled. Its politics, in my view, I'd be interested in our historian's perspective, it's pretty much always been controlled by real estate developers. It has industries. It had the oil industry. It has the entertainment industry. It had the aerospace industry, and they were important. But the driving force has really been real estate developers. And you see it even today, where the simplest type of regulation gets bottled up in the city council because the city council just can't get out of its own way when it comes to regulating real estate. The other thing that I'll say is L.A., when it came of age at a time where we had diffuse political power, and you can't forget that about Los Angeles also, that you have 15 council members, Zev knows this very well, who essentially control fiefdoms and won't give up their land use authority, which creates, puts a premium on access to political power, to having the right consultants, the right lobbyists, the right access to these 15 kings and queens that will determine the future of your development prospect. That is what drives Los Angeles to this day.
Let me just add that in addition to these 15 queens and kings, you have independent municipalities
right.
within the county of LA also having, in some instances, independent planning boards. That's all I wanted to say about that point.
I think this is all true. I'm not sure that LA is unique in that capacity. I mean, you know, the United States is a capitalist society. And under capitalism, I think you need to go macro in terms of thinking about the role of capitalism here in fueling speculation and development and the diffusion of political power. But I would be careful not to stress too much of a top-down model, because LA has always been kind of a, I think of LA as kind of a popular city, especially if you think about the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. The suburban ideal was a powerful force that shaped settlement in Los Angeles. Ideas about domesticity, ideas about the family, ideas about the bungalow and the single-family home. And there was intense demand for this new pattern of settlement that was not New York, it was not Boston, it was not Chicago. It was an opportunity for a more healthful, salubrious climate, sun-kissed vision of suburban domesticity that was available to certain segments of the population. Not everyone, of course, could access that suburban dream. But there was, from below, a popular demand for a new kind of urbanism that LA sold through a highly contrived advertising campaign, largely concocted by the Southern Pacific and Santa Fe railroads, that happened to coincide with the introduction of new technologies like the streetcar and later the automobile.
Right.
So I think you have to look at both kind of the top-down and the bottom-up to understand why LA is the way it is.
Did you want to, Steve, weigh in on
realtors? I just watched that documentary where, aren't you in the documentary?
I'm in the documentary.
Yes.
Which one?
It's called Lost LA on KCET.
Right.
On the subject of gentrification, and I know that Boyle Heights is in the title of this, is it not?
That's right.
Just to draw people in. Really,
but I have found in my reporting that this is not a great bulletin. There are winners and losers. And, for instance, the coffee shop in Boyle Heights that was mentioned. There was opposition to this following the opposition that there had been to the art galleries. I don't know how Dave Kippen here had no opposition to Libros Schmibros, but he didn't. Well, maybe. But so I went to the neighborhood where this coffee shop had been vandalized, and as soon as these guys opened it, this was interesting. The face of the little coffee shop was two white guys. There was a Latino investor who was pretty much the guy in charge who hadn't shown up. So it looked like maybe the opposition died off a bit when they learned who was behind this. But as I talked to merchants up and down the street and customers, they were coming from all over. And they were saying, we will not have these people driven out because of their skin color. And, you know, there were people lined up to buy the coffee. And if you went to the store next door and the one next door to that, people had their coffee from this little coffee shop. And yet, I spoke to the guy who rented these guys the space. And he said, yes, rents are going to go up because of this. This is going to be a destination. So there are winners and there are losers. And that is happening, I would argue, in every neighborhood right now. I began my day-to-day this morning in the home of a woman in South Central LA. She's a dispatcher for the City of Los Angeles Transportation Department. She makes $78,000 a year. And she was packing. She rents a three-bedroom house near 82nd and Vermont. And her rent in 4 years has gone from $1,800. The latest increase will take it above $3,000. This is South LA. I left there and went to East LA, where a woman living in City Terrace has a sign in her window, I'm not leaving. Her rent is $1,200. The landlord has increased it to $2,000. So those would not be thought of as gentrifying neighborhoods.
Right.
But that's the beginning of gentrification, and it happens everywhere. And one interesting thing about both of those is that the landlords are not mom-and-pop landlords. They're corporations. Mm-hmm. And corporations are buying huge amounts of real estate in California, in Los Angeles, across the country, and beginning to, I don't quite understand securitization, but selling pieces of these huge investments to other investors, all of whom want a return on their investment, which means that the rents are going to continue to rise, and as they do, as this corporate game plays out, the mom and pops, who are still in the majority, are certainly going to raise their rents as well. So I think we're going to see much more gentrification because we don't have enough new housing to support the population growth, and people are moving east. I mean, the woman in City Terrace said, I'm thinking of moving to Nevada. The woman in South LA said, maybe I'm going to the Inland Empire. I once drove and checked rents from Santa Monica to Yucca Valley. Every 50 miles is $1,000 a month on the rent. And when you get to Yucca Valley and Joshua Tree, you can buy a house for $180,000 and rent a place for a nice place for $1,100, but there are no jobs.
Right.
So it's a problem that California is going to continue to wrestle with for months and for years to come. And then we get to, okay, what are the public policy considerations? What, if anything, should we do about that?
Well, we often hear posited that Los Angeles needs more construction, that we need more quantity of rental units, and development and growth is the answer. So how do you balance that growth with the sort of ills and side effects of gentrification? How do you manage that push-pull? And whoever wants to start.
I would argue that you get different community stakeholders at the table. It's a difficult thing to do because you have differential power relations. You have developers with millions of dollars. You have some individual homeowners that bring certain capital as well to the table. And then you have others who are trying to collectively gather power through organizing and other sorts of protests. They should be at the table when it comes to development. It should not be unfettered, in part with what is going on in the downtown part of Los Angeles, where you have very little say by local residents. And so I think it needs to be managed to a certain extent where folks can somehow come together and engage in these sorts of negotiations. Again, there's a huge power dynamic, and I think that's the big issue.
But what we're talking about is moderating capitalism. And so having folks sitting at the table is really different than having somebody who can intervene on behalf of those who really don't have power. And that's where government comes in, theoretically local government or even regional government. One thing that we can't forget to mention when we talk about gentrification that's really current right now, and those of us who are working on development issues and public policy and transportation, is the massive investment in public transportation. That is driving some of the increased property values in some of these communities that we're talking about. Not the ones you mentioned, particularly, Steve, but certainly Boyle Heights is driven by the fact, I think, a lot, largely because of the Gold Line. So we have just passed a measure that is going to infuse $120 billion into this region, the largest investment in transportation, of public transportation and transit in the country. It is a game changer. So you look at the map of the expenditure plan and everywhere those lines are planned to go, you can map the future of gentrification if it is done without any intent to address the inevitable issues of displacement. So how do we address it? Is we have public policy interventions. We do things like having inclusionary housing, which up until the day the governor signed the Bloom legislation, there was question about whether local governments could impose inclusionary housing. That is going to be essential to we have to do preservation strategies so that we can buy up blocks of housing or buy down the affordability of existing, what we call naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOAA, the kind of stuff that these ladies were living in. They were affordable up until, two or three years ago, if folks had started to purchase covenants in those buildings anticipating gentrification. they could probably preserve that housing at a fraction of the cost as it would take to replace it with new affordable or low-income housing. So there are a number of interventions we can take, but it actually takes leadership at the policy level, at the public policy elected official level. And we are seeing the passage of Measure H and HHH, and I would maybe argue JJJ, some degree of the crisis has gotten so bad that even local elected officials here in Los Angeles have to act and intervene in the marketplace. But without an intervening entity to balance out capital's power, just bringing community members around the table won't really result in anything, right? Because capital has so much authority here in our region.
I also think that, you know, we need to learn from history. And when we talk about Boyle Heights, I think we should remember that Boyle Heights and Los Angeles are not the only cities to have struggled with gentrification. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of literature on Paris in the 19th century, which was, you know, the birth of gentrification, if you want to think about it, perhaps even the birth of capitalism. And a lot of scholars have looked at anti-gentrification struggles in Paris during the 1860s, 1870s. That's a big kind of macro historical context that I think is important for understanding what's happening here right now in Boyle Heights. But I also think that, you know, we need to think about the history of Boyle Heights in the 20th century. I think of Boyle Heights as kind of the neglected stepchild of Los Angeles communities. It's a community that has been pushed around, bulldozed, quarantined, isolated. If you think about the history of highway construction in Boyle Heights, I mean, you just need to look at a map of Los Angeles and you'll see that all of the major freeway arteries in Los Angeles converge directly upon Boyle Heights. And this happened during the 1950s and 1960s when literally an army of bulldozers invaded Boyle Heights, dislodging a very, very diverse concentration of working class people, largely immigrant communities, from all over the world. And today, I think historians have kind of a nostalgic vision of Boyle Heights as the global city that once was, or the prototype for LA's current phase of global urban development. But Boyle Heights was a global city going back to the 1920s and 1930s, where it sheltered a very diverse concentration of people. Unfortunately, during the mid-20th century, the state, and I mean, you know, municipal, state, and federal policymakers viewed that diversity not as an asset, but as a liability. And because of that racial and ethnic and working class diversity of Boyle Heights was redlined. It was isolated from the flow of capital and wealth in Southern California. And it was also a target for slum clearance projects like highway construction in the 1950s and 60s. And that process of building freeways in Boyle Heights is what dislodged a lot of that historic diversity and what enabled Boyle Heights to transition into an undiverse, more monolithic concentration of racial poverty as Boyle Heights emerged as a barrio, a working class Mexican-American neighborhood in Los Angeles from roughly 1970s onward. So that's an important part of the Boyle Heights story that I think is missing in the current debates around gentrification. I think we need to remember that Boyle Heights has always been in the cycles of change, of constant change, of violent change, of upheaval. That's always been a part of Boyle Heights' history. But as my fellow panelists are reminding us, there are always winners and losers in that story. As with the current round of gentrification in 21st century Los Angeles, there are winners and losers as well.
So has there been, so we're seeing a little bit of opposition to gentrification in Boyle Heights right now. Has there consistently been sort of a community activism in that neighborhood?
There is a history of community activism. There was a tremendous degree of activism against the incursion of freeways in Boyle Heights during the 1950s, but that didn't work. So that's what sparked white flight out of Boyle Heights to the west side, to the valley. That's also what sparked the rise of a undiverse concentration of black poverty in South Central Los Angeles and of Mexican-American poverty in East Los Angeles as well.
There are also examples of victories. For example, groups of women who organized against the location of incinerators in Boyle Heights, very successful, based on arguments of morality, children, families, and maintaining community, and highly, highly successful. I think there's also some current examples of trying to link some of the current displacement that's going on with a broader immigrant rights movement related to detention and deportation by some younger sorts of activists, really interesting sorts of links, I think, in part to link up with some of the activism going on in downtown Los Angeles over some of these issues as well. So I think we're seeing some nascent sorts of interesting grassroots organizing, I think.
And then, Cecilia, I wanted to ask you a little bit of insight on this question, because Boyle Heights has also struggled to bring affordable housing into the neighborhood. And there's been opposition, maybe not from the same folks, but to a particular affordable housing proposal in the neighborhood. Why is that? What's going on?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, this is so Rena's talking about a proposal that's been on the books and been really worked at for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now, with a really high-quality, affordable housing developer, and received a lot of support from the city, even from the city council member, who ultimately felt pressure from local community members, property owners, and in the end opposed the project. It was quite a surprise, actually. So what I think you're seeing is this. So on the one hand, Boyle Heights is a place that's been disinvested in up until this current cycle, I think is fair to say. And so when I was the head of the Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles, we were trying to figure out how to get investment in that community. And now it's seeing investment. And there's, because of the rapidity of increased property values, there's a lot of pressure to resist that. And so some of the things that Steve was mentioning, you know, the protest against that coffee shop. But on the other hand, you have folks that say, hey, we've been dumped on. We've gotten more than our fair share of affordable housing. You know, all of these affordable housing projects that are coming into Boyle Heights, because the land up until this point, relatively speaking, is cheaper than other places, means that affordable housing developers are able to buy up property and are able to layer in the various forms of financing and make these projects pencil out. So there's also been, in some of the Gold Line stops, up until just a few years ago, you really couldn't pencil out a market rate development. So Metro had developers of affordable housing coming in, purchasing property near these sites, using Metro-owned land as leverage as well to put in affordable housing. That was a good thing because it increased the number of folks living near the transit stop. It replaced some blighted properties with actually quality affordable housing. So that was seen as a good. But folks in the community feel like, enough already. We have an over-concentration of low-income housing, affordable housing. Why do we need to have permanent supportive housing with people who have disabilities or have other substance abuse problems? We don't need to be the dumping ground of these folks. Abel mentioned the incinerator project, but the group was Mothers of East LA. They also fought a prison successfully, the placement of a prison in their community. So there's all that residual sense of, we are the dumping ground. Hard to put it anyplace else. It ends up in our community. We're just as good as anybody else. And if the folks on the west side can resist an affordable housing project, we sure as heck can. So, again, it requires leadership, right? It requires leadership to say, actually, this is a great project. And actually, the residents are going to be coming from here. Actually, we need more housing for special needs populations. In fact, some of you may have relatives, friends, and neighbors that actually could use this assistance and this wraparound services that we provided in this development by this really excellent affordable housing developer. So you're going to see both of those things happening in Boyle Heights. I also want to talk a little bit about, we talked about income. I don't want to leave this discussion. I know the Dodgers game is going to happen soon. Without talking about, we're talking about displacement and gentrification, right? And Boyle Heights is an example. I think Eric mentioned South LA. I think another really important example that folks should be looking at is Crenshaw. With the arrival of not just the Expo line, but now the Crenshaw line, you're seeing the same types of development pressures on a very stable African-American community. Traditionally a middle-class African-American community that people forget over the last 20 to 30 years has become increasingly Latino. right? It was, again, when we were in redevelopment times, we were trying to figure out how do we keep these communities vibrant? How do we make sure they get the kind of retail they need, that they don't have to leave the community to go shopping? How do we revive the mall, the Crenshaw Baldwin Hills Plaza? Well, now that's got tons of investment coming into it. So all of these things are finally happening in communities that have always felt left behind. But the change is coming fast, and it makes people uncomfortable. So I want to argue that we have a problem with housing. We need more housing to be built at all different income levels, and the market will not build housing except for luxury housing because we have a market failure, and that's where intervention from government has to happen. Second, what this really is about is an income problem. If you trace it all back, the problem is poverty. The problem is people are really poor in Los Angeles or they're really pretty affluent. And most of those middle-class jobs are pretty hard to find. And we are a bifurcated economy. Why do we have the most unaffordable housing market in the country? Not just because rents are high, but because incomes are very low in Los Angeles. Okay? A quarter of our population is in poverty. That's an astonishing statistic. Maybe we're inured to it because we're just used to hearing about it, but it's really a shocking statistic. So I would say, if we really want to address gentrification and displacement, we have to address the root causes. It's people need more money, which means they need better jobs, which means we need to do better than just producing crummy retail and service jobs. So when we have an economic development strategy that wants to build on things like advanced manufacturing, a resurgent aerospace industry, a bioscience industry, all of these things are growing in this region. How do we connect up the people who live in poor gentrifying areas, or used to be, who are poor living in gentrifying areas, to employment opportunities in our growing best class sectors? We need to spend a lot of attention on that, as well as addressing the affordable housing crisis, no doubt, as well as intervening into kind of relentless market forces that are going to invest like lemmings in the next hot thing, right? I mean, that is how real estate works. That's how capitalism works. And that's why downtown, that huge development in downtown is actually seeing pressure to reduce those rents. They're making enormous concessions just to fill up those towers now, right? So you're going to see a market correction downtown. The point I wanted to make is we are talking about gentrification and displacement. We have to deal with income and economic development in a profound way. And that is something that LA hasn't done a very good job at. And that needs to change. There have been some recent leadership on the Board of Supervisors looking at things like bioscience, looking at economic development, but it's not muscles that they're used to stretching, and they don't actually have the institutions and the kind of the staff ready to go do that. We need to shift to some of that. Otherwise, we're going to be running to stay in place.
So, Steve, you're out in the world all the time talking to people. What are people saying? Do people feel connected to City Hall? Do they feel empowered to kind of get involved in the process and start pushing for some of these policy solutions these guys have been talking about?
Well, I see a lot more radicalized people who are becoming engaged and trying to find out, like, as a renter, what are my renter's rights? There are a lot of movements now around these rent increases and what can and should be done. I agree that so much of this is, I thought that you nailed it, that so much of this is tied to, while rents and property values rise, wages for the most part have been pretty flat. And I think we're really headed for trouble. I would like to think that there are some big answers on the horizon. But I don't see us replacing manufacturing jobs. I don't see us replacing the blue-collar aerospace jobs. It seems to me that those, you know, what jobs there are in those industries have gone from blue-collar to white-collar. Mm-hmm. And when the Boeing plant closed in Long Beach, I hung for a year with employees who didn't go past high school. But it was a union job, and they made $40 an hour. So they bought houses in, you know, Lakewood, and their kids went to Cal State University somewhere, and there are these pathways to upward mobility. And I don't hear much of a discussion about how to replace those kinds of jobs. I don't know what they're going to be. And I think another reason I feel a little pessimistic about things is I focus a lot on middle-aged people and older. who, in my contacts with them, are in a panic. They're in crisis. And I think for many older people, retiring people, who have not planned well or just didn't have an opportunity to put much money away, we're headed for a crisis. Mm-hmm. We have the combination of the housing shortage and rising prices and an explosion of people on fixed incomes. I've been working on a column about a woman who called me desperate and in tears from Arleta, saying, I live in a garage in a neighborhood in Arleta, and I don't think it's legal. Can you please come and look at it? So I go and I look at it, and it turns out that somebody who owned a house, typical residential street in Arleta, carved it up into 9 units. 9 people live there. So I asked this woman, what do you pay? She said, I pay $1,100 a month. She has one half of a two-car garage. There's a neighbor on the other side of it, and I said, well, $1,100, that's a lot of money. What's your income? She said, $1,100. So every cent goes to, you know, her living expenses, and she said if not for a sister who gives her a couple dollars here and there, she'd be in trouble. I think we're going to see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in that same situation with nowhere to go. And when I write about these people, I hear from readers saying, who cares? They didn't plan well enough. Why don't they move to Iowa? Why don't they move to the Inland Empire? And I say, well, some of them do. Some of them want to stay close to family or to places where they're familiar, you know, surroundings or their doctor. And then I get, well, I wrote about the keyboardist from Frank Zappa's band who's being moved out of his house in Highland Park with a rent increase. And he qualified for Section 8. He's 85 years old. And readers said, why should I have to subsidize housing for a guy from Frank Zappa's band who didn't put enough money away? And I emailed back and I said, do you live in a house? Yes. Have you had it for a while? Yes. I said, why should I have to subsidize your mortgage deduction and your Prop 13 property tax break that I'm subsidizing because I moved to the street after you? So people who think that, you know, they're getting dinged by all of these costs and they don't want to hear about a parcel tax or inclusionary zoning or any other measure that might balance things a bit and give people a chance to live in decent housing, you know, let's look at the big picture. I think we have to make some tough public policy choices to deal with a crisis that's only going to get worse.
Yeah. And let me... also suggest that there are efforts afoot, right? So we can't ignore the role of organized labor in Los Angeles and what some call a renaissance, if you will, of union density growing. It's one of the few places in the country where we have union density that's growing. We passed, as a state, minimum wage that's going to eventually come to $15 an hour, right? These are really important interventions. We also have increased workplace protections, pushes to provide health insurance for workers. All of this has come about through a change in our elected officials in Sacramento who make these sorts of connections to neighborhoods and income and wealth. So while these efforts are afoot, I don't want to suggest that things are changing wholesale, because they're not. These are small, important matters that I think we'll realize in more long-term outcomes. But these are just steps that we need to be taking. We need to do much more than that, I think.
So, I mean, talking about that kind of like incremental policy steps here and there, you know, measures here, ballot measures here for bonds and you know, sales taxes to fund homeless services, is that enough, or are we talking about solving affordability with like massive wealth redistribution? Like, is there any other way to get there?
I actually think Steve's right that we're headed into a dark period, and I think the national election has mobilized people to really reassess things. I think you're going to see a serious critique of capitalism in the next 5 to 10 years that we haven't seen in 40 years. And I think people are going to, I don't know about the massive redistribution of wealth. We actually do that in California. We have a really skewed income tax that is actually a problem for us. We go through these boom and bust cycles, and that's a whole other panel. But really important, we're doing super progressive tax policy here. But what I think may happen is California leading the way on climate change stuff and cap and trade, showing the government can intervene and shift an economy, the feedstock of an economy from petroleum to a clean energy economy, in the face of just massive opposition from the federal government is interesting. We're doing amazing things in California. I actually brought a prop, which is from the Transformative Climate Communities Program. It's a new grant program out of Cap and Trade. $140 million is going to go to Fresno, someplace in LA, and some other community. $140 million. And one of the so there's a whole grant competition going on, but one of the things you have to put in your grant application is how you're going to address displacement. And they actually provide a starter set of policies that local government can implement, including inclusionary housing, including business assistance, including rent control. It's fascinating. This isn't a state document to distribute money that's basically collected out of the dirty energy economy and being redistributed to, and this Transformative Community Climate Communities Program can only go to the most disadvantaged communities in the state of California, the top 5% in the CalEnviro screen, right? So we're trying to take $140 million just this year alone and redistribute it there. But I use that as an example because I think that critique of capitalism may result in this radical notion that government, a new type of government, a new, you know, reinvigorated government, can do bold things like build massive amounts of housing, different types of housing. I have a young staff. We have a company that's been around for about almost 7 years now, and our staff, almost all of them came from this program, actually, UCLA. And one of them asked me, one of the smartest members of our staff said, did government ever build housing? He was a transportation planner at UCLA. You'll give him credit. You know. I said, yeah, they did. We did. Massive amounts of housing were built by government, and let's talk to you about that history. Because most of the folks in government today that are sort of ascending came to age, and I'm even talking about folks in leadership and legislature, came of age in the height of kind of the neoconservative backlash against progressive policies of the 60s. So they came of age in the Reagan years, where government was the enemy. People like forgot that government could be a force for good and could actually build big things. That's why we are having such a hard time building a freaking high-speed rail network, right? But my point, Rena, is that I think because of all these terrible tensions that are happening and this like massive dislocation that's going to be happening, people are going to say, who's the only thing that can check capital? Government. And darn it, we're going to take back government and make it do really big things in different ways than it did in the 60s. Different ways. That's my prediction.
I think that's a really good point. For me, there's a huge irony here because that critique of capitalism that you're talking about was alive and well in Boyle Heights in the 1930s.
In
the 1930s, Boyle Heights was a locus of multiracial, multi-ethnic, working class union activism. That was strong in Boyle Heights, and it was part of the culture, the shared culture of Boyle Heights. So we need to go back to that history, I think, to find our path forward.
With that, we've got about 8 minutes left, so that gives you 2 minutes each to basically give advice. What would you like to tell the future policymakers in Los Angeles? What advice would you give? Because there might be some in the room. Who knows?
Well, you know, I think a lot about the history of Boyle Heights and the you know, correcting the wrongs of the past. I see this as a very, very complicated issue. It is certainly a class issue. It's also a racial issue because that's the history of Boyle Heights. I think that it's, you know, from what I'm learning about current strategies of activism against gentrification in Boyle Heights, I do think there are some misguided strategies. But I think you have to remember that, you know, for the past 40 years, Boyle Heights has been a barrio. It's been a Mexican-American community. And the thought of displacement and gentrification for a lot of Mexican-Americans in Southern California really hits a nerve for people who remember the Mexican-American War, for people who remember the history of land dispossession and displacement. This brings up that nightmare all over again. And as, you know, misguided as we might think it is to vandalize an art gallery or a cafe, I think you need to remember that bigger historical picture to understand the vehemence with which current activists are struggling to fight the forces of gentrification and displacement in 21st century Boyle Heights.
I think in some ways, gentrifying neighborhoods are the most interesting in LA right now. For all of the conflict, for all of the problems, and all the fears of displacement, they're interesting, and one reason is that they're diverse. They're changing, and I you know, that's all very interesting, and many people can benefit from it until you get to where avocado toast is $14. You know, the battle's been lost. It's all over. As far as what do you do, in my travels, when I talk to folks in the trenches with the nonprofits, trying to speak up for renters, trying to speak up for those who are displaced, what I hear over and over is calls for broader rent stabilization, which has its critics, and it's very difficult to get that through. And then you have people arguing that you know, that will limit new development. And the other thing I hear a lot of is Costa Hawkins,
right?
Which, you know, allows,
maybe explain what that is.
Well, I'd let one of the policy people do it, but what it allows. If you're asking how is it that a woman living in a house in South L.A. can have a rent increase from $1,800 to $3,000 in just a couple of years, it's because there's no limit. It's because they can do what they want under what's known as Costa Hawkins. And
can we
to get into the weeds, I'll let one of the policy people pick it up.
So,
can we get a brief?
So there's a couple of things. There's a Costa Hawkins and there's Ellis Act. Just briefly, there's a... in response to rent control in places like West Hollywood, Berkeley, and Santa Monica that had vacancy control, control, where even if you left your unit and you moved on, that unit stayed rent controlled, was only allowed a little bit of an increase. I know. Back then, there was a point at which that there were three cities that could do that, okay? Berkeley, West Hollywood, and Santa Monica, just three off. There may have been San Francisco, but basically they could control rent increases even if somebody moved out. Apartment owners lobbied at the legislature and passed something called Costa Hawkins that eliminated that type of rent control. It also said something, sorry, I'm a lawyer, notwithstanding any other provision of law, is this phrase, the property or apartment owner shall set the initial rates, meaning government shall not set them, which people interpreted to mean you couldn't require inclusionary housing, okay? And there's some lawsuits that went up the courts and negated the ability of cities to require a certain amount of low-income housing when new housing was built, right? You're going to build 100 units, 20% of them have to be for poor people. That inclusionary housing got challenged, people citing Costa Hawkins. So those 1-2 punch kind of undercut the most aggressive form of rent control, also seem to limit government's ability to mandate that new development also include housing for poor people. And then there's another law, the Ellis Act, that allows people to take their housing units off the market and then kind of boot people out, and then what you would see them do is put it back on the market at a much higher level. So if you put that all together, it's created a very anti-renter environment. Some of that, there were 15 housing bills passed by the legislature that are significant that the governor signed. One of them clarifies that inclusionary housing is allowed. Others are trying to increase the ability of folks' renters' rights. So all that to say, people maybe have not read the law, but they heard that phrase because probably they've been told you don't have any rights because of this thing called Costa Hawkins.
Well, and the repeal among the bills introduced this year, one that didn't make it, was a repeal of Costa Hawkins.
Yeah. Yes.
COSTA hyphen Hawkins, Hawkins.
Yeah.
Two legislators.
Yeah.
One Democrat, one Republican.
What year?
1986.
86,
right? Yeah,
85,
86.
Pete Wilson signed it, I believe.
Yeah, but I believe Willie Brown supported it. Yeah. Let's be clear about this, folks.
That's right.
Okay? This is not a Republican-Democrat thing. This is a capital thing.
By
City of Los Angeles, part of the rent control law, charter amendment from the ballot, exempted all new construction post-1990.
Yep. That is correct. And so every time an old building that was built before 1978 is demolished in Los Angeles and replaced with a new building, you've lost rent-controlled units that will not be replaced by rent control. So over time, that 680,000 or maybe it was 800,000 units of rent control has diminished down to about 500,000. We lose units every year in the city of Los Angeles.
Here's another way that LSAC works. I did a story on a family in Echo Park. They had been renting a house for something like 20 years, and the house was sold, and the new owner told his tenants he was going to demolish the house, evict them, and build four condos on that one plot, which he did, each for $1 million.
Right.
And the family got, what is it, $18,000 relocation under the Ellis Act, but the owner was allowed to do that. So, just think of the change there. Four people who could buy a $1 million condo replacing one family that paid $1,500 a month rent.
So you'd repeal Costa-Hawkins?
What's that?
You would repeal Costa-Hawkins. That would be your advice? And the Ellis Act?
Or modify it in some way. It's, okay. Yeah.
And did you have any closing thoughts, or did
would you
should
not?
We jump to?
No, I have one. I have a quick one.
Okay. Would you repeat?
Here's what. I would say to policymakers: be bold enough, not just to try to take on things that are scary and piss off people, but be bold enough to cede a little bit of power to the community, to listen to them, to listen to their voices, and to help them learn the process. Okay, because they will give you power. But you have to give up some of it. And I'll give you a brief example. It'll be brief, Rena. Hilda Solis is a supervisor on the east side, right? Also represents Boyle Heights. She has convened this group called the Community Health Partnership because the county has a bunch of land where the county general hospital is. It's right next to a bunch of USC's medical school. And she said, okay, we're going to manage this land in a way that benefits the community. I have some ideas on how to do that, but I'm going to convene this big group of community residents who are all, like, sophisticated, they hit up nonprofits, they've been trained, da-da-da-da. Plus, I'm going to make county staff show up, and I'm going to try to bring USC to the table. USC has not come to the table. But she's convened this group and put a bunch of money into getting them to inform her how she should make policy around county investments on the land owned by the county. That's scary, okay, because many of these groups have been invested in by the California Endowment and are really organized and have a really strong event agenda and will really push her. So she's ceding some power, right? She's ceding some power so that that group will empower her with their best ideas so she can battle it out with USC. That's my political analysis. But she'll be stronger for it, right? So that's being bold, but it's also being bold enough to give up a little power so that everybody sits at the table. Listen, that's my advice.
Great. Did you want to jump in quick?
Real quick, okay. Two things. I think we need to be really, really thoughtful about people who are being displaced and what that means. Children, elderly, families, long-term residents. So when we talk about this sort of issue, there are real lives here at stake. The second is, what could we possibly do? I just want to reiterate that I think the role of the state has to be central. They created a lot of these issues and problems, and in that same way, we need to reverse some of these policies and create new ones. We should not be shy about pushing elected officials to intervene. I say that in part because when I advocate for policies related to labor markets, I talk about the role of the state. Yeah. They have to be involved.
Great. So let's go to questions. Are we just shouting them out, or you guys have a mic? Okay, roving mic.
I didn't know you were a labor.
We should talk.
I know, of course we will. Yeah. Hi. Thank you to all of the panelists. I think it's been very informative. But I have a bone to pick with the name of this panel. We have to throw out the word gentrification. This is not about gentrification.
I agree.
This is about rapacious development. That's all it's about.
is a lot.
And, you know, if you think about the history of that word, it's a very important thing. We all know how powerful words are these days, the true ones and the lies. And gentrification is a lie. It has a very nice sound. It's, what are you doing? Making something gentle, more delightful? Strike that word from your vocabulary when you talk about this problem. Please, please. Gentrification comes from a period 50 or 60 years ago when very derelict neighborhoods in places like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago were actually being improved because city services came in, they had their garbage picked up once in a while and things like that. That was gentrification. What's happening in Los Angeles is not gentrification. It is rapid, it's profiteering is what it is. That garage is a great example. And we need controls so that people are not displaced from their homes. This is not about gentrification.
Thank you.
We see everywhere people being put out of their homes without protection, these few bucks of relocations, that's myth, terrible. That's ridiculous. And what's happening is rapacious people come in. You know, it used to be 20 years ago, slumlords were content to own slum buildings and just take a lot of money from people and make no repairs and not, do it, follow the law. That's not what's happening anymore. Now they're coming in and knocking those buildings down. And I'm sure everyone in this room knows that L.A. is the homeless capital of the world. We have more homeless people. We have 48,000 homeless people every night in Los Angeles.
So I just want to make sure everybody gets a chance. So thank you so much for that comment. That was nice.
Yeah, go up there.
You mentioned that L.A., the 25% of the population is below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. How does that measure against other cities? That doesn't sound unusual to me.
It is unusual. We have one of the highest poverty rates. I think we have the highest poverty rate in the nation.
When housing is factored in.
Yeah, well,
when you account for a cost of living.
All cities or a city this size? Or
no, cities across the country.
Cities across the country.
Yeah.
There are also different measures of poverty. There are, for example, we have the highest concentration of the working poor, right? So we have lots of folks who work multiple jobs. When you add up the numbers, they still fall below the poverty threshold, which is a combination of household size. So it's a huge problem, and it's complicated, and it crosses across different races, right? So it's not just immigrants, nor is it Mexicans only or African Americans, but it also includes a large indigenous population, for example, as well as a large white population that falls under the poverty threshold. So it's scope, and that's part related to Los Angeles and our size.
And like Steve was saying, this is kind of when you factor in cost of living.
That's right.
If you look at just the official poverty measure, things are a little different. Okay. Sure. So we're going to take a few questions at once and then get responses.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, the potential indicators of gentrification and displacement would include maybe early on, sure, coffee, art galleries, but then soon enough, grad students and journalists who come to study it and write it and explain it to the rest of us. So I would ask, especially since UCLA is embarking on a project about Boyle Heights specifically, and eventually, I suppose, the larger issues that it raises, and even the journalists up there, how can you go about what you do in a way that's responsible and sensitive and even useful?
And we're going to get a few in a row and then have people respond. So
we've got a couple hands over here. I have one question early on. One of you mentioned the fact that what it really takes is leadership. I'd like some comments on our city leadership and how you think we can make some changes.
And then let's get one from this side of the room here. Just wait for the mic.
Industry moving out. The issue you haven't covered in regentrification is education and retooling these people to be qualified for higher paying jobs. I think that's a very important aspect of any part of our economy.
California community colleges.
Community college is great, but then you have to have, and the year of non-paying education is wonderful, but you have to make sure these people are aware of this and expose them to it.
There's been a long awareness in Boyle Heights about the educational disenfranchisement of people living in that part of the city. There's student activism in the 1970s and 1980s demanding better teachers, demanding more resources in the classroom. This is has been a flashpoint for youth activism in Boyle Heights going way back decades.
And do we have a response to some of the other questions we heard? We heard what can an individual do to help the situation, and what is the problem, I guess, with city leadership? did any of you guys want to respond to one of those?
What's the problem with leadership? There are powerful lobbies that are involved. I don't think it's a great exaggeration to say that the halls of power in Los Angeles at the city and county level are perhaps most influenced by organized labor and by development, developers. As much as they might like to deny it, I think that public officials are inclined to listen to what the demands of those lobbies are. So I don't know, maybe this ends up becoming a discussion about campaign finance reform, because we have the leadership that the powerful lobbies pay for, and I do think, though, that one answer is community organizing efforts to speak up and bring a third lobby into the discussion, and perhaps as more and more people are displaced, we'll see more of that. It certainly would be nice to see.
Historians of labor really pay attention to Los Angeles for the past 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
And so in that same context, I think we need to pay attention to some of LA's progressive infrastructure, for example, and what that means in this broader context. But I think you're right. I think it's thinking about how the city has changed in certain segments, right? The green movement, the labor movement. These are movements that have been successful during a period of extreme pushback by the federal government, right? $15 an hour, that's a huge, huge victory. I would argue the most important anti-poverty sort of intervention on behalf of the state. And it's addressing the demand side, right? It's upgrading industries, poor-paying minimum wage jobs. That's one intervention. Another is what was suggested around the room, human capacity, investments in education, something that I and many of us in this room think has been hampered. Prop 13 comes to mind, though there's some pushback against that we're hearing, and of course other sorts of intervention by a legislature that now is paying attention to disenfranchised poor folks, immigrants, and Latinos. And so there are some movements afoot that I think we should pay attention to in this larger project debate.
Can we get another question on the education just for a second? California Community Colleges, the largest system of higher education in the world, 2.1 million students. Two-thirds of our students go for free on Board of Governors waivers.
We used to have trade schools.
We do. They're called the California Community Colleges, right? That's where our vocational or career education happens. I'm president of the Board of Governors of California Community Colleges, so I know. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to need 1 million workers in the state in the next 10 years that have those middle skills, that need certificates. They don't need a four-year degree. They need a certificate of some sort. And the California Community Colleges, we've put a huge emphasis on that with a lot of support from the legislature. So we're seeing historic amounts of investment going on that for the very point that you're making. We need to retool people, and not just once. We're going to need to be retooled several times in our careers. So we are trying to put a spotlight on career education, that this is a pathway that's really opening opportunities for folks. It's different. You can't get that $40 an hour job with a high school degree anymore, but you might be able to get it with a certificate in biotech or radiology from East LA Community College, Pasadena City College, Santa Monica College.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a small question. I think it was Eric who mentioned misguided strategies and then I think loop back to vandalism. Are there other misguided strategies you would identify, or maybe some of the others of you would identify?
We have one more. I'm
kind of rehashing what I think.
Can we go back here?
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Forgot the rules.
It's tough.
Here, then we'll maybe ask Zeb to make a final.
I just wanted to ask about the tension between ceding community control and NIMBYism.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So I think one of the biggest problems with this discussion is this widespread phenomenon, even in working class and communities of color, owed in part to the trauma of displacement, owed to freeways and activism around prisons and land use. How do we balance those two things? We want to cede community control, but no one wants homeless housing in their backyard. No one wants low-income housing in their backyard. So, and in some ways, this is rooted in exactly what Eric identified as the sort of vision of grassroots home ownership really catching on. It was a very bottom-up thing. Workers in Boyle Heights loved that they could own their own homes, live near work, communicate by streetcar. So I guess I'm just wondering, I don't have any answers to that, but how can we push Angelenos, our fellow Angelenos, to think about new ways of sharing space, of inhabiting space, of moving through the city that may be conducive to sort of reimagining this thing, this vision of community life and moving a little bit beyond NIMBYism. I think there's probably a lot of people in this room that'll talk a lot about affordable housing but would never allow affordable housing in their neighborhoods. And so I just want to, how can we culturally, zeitgeist-wise, I think it gets to David's question about sort of academics and reporters, how can we open up
right,
this
how
new...
do we do this? How do we fight NIMBYism in Los Angeles? I think that's a huge question. Does anyone want to tackle that? Oh, you want to go? Let Zeb go first? Okay.
I don't have a question per se. I just want to make a comment in the context of this is a history and policy center that is sponsoring this, and there's something to be learned from history.
Yeah.
In 1978, when the property values in California, and particularly in Los Angeles County, skyrocketed, the mid-70s, Howard Jarvis came to the quote-unquote rescue of property owners, many of whom were my constituents, and put a cap and rolled back property taxes and put a cap on the growth of property taxes. At the very same time, for the very same reason, rents were skyrocketing all over the West Side, the San Fernando Valley, not so much in the economically marginal areas of the city. And the city council at that time, which was predominantly white, but philosophically very diverse, enacted a rent control law. A moratorium on rents in 1978. It was, in a sense, Howard Jarvis Prop 13 for renters.
Yeah.
It was approved, the moratorium was extended in 1979, and then finally, the rent control law rolled back retroactively rents to the pre-Prop 13 levels. The price we had to pay at that time for the apartment house industry was to put that charter amendment on the ballot that said all new construction would be exempt from rent control. Right. Now, I make, especially to you, Abel, as the labor representative here, now you have a city council that touts itself as universally and homogeneously progressive, and there hasn't been a single effort on the part of this or many of the other city councils in the county to resurrect rent control. We can talk jobs.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm not advocating any particular thing, but I just want to raise, when you talk about, we responded at that time in the late 70s to a crisis that was facing mainly our elderly who were renters. We're now in a crisis. Steve hit the nail on the head. We are in a crisis. We don't have to wait for the crisis. And how long will it take before organized labor in Los Angeles County makes that a high priority issue? You can build housing till you're blue in the face. You will never catch up with the demand is much greater than we can produce supply. In the meantime, what do you do for these people who cannot afford to live in their substandard housing? $1,100 a month garage. That's the kind of thing that needs to be addressed, and it will be addressed. I mean, the legislature has started with the Costa-Hawkins debate. It won't be easy in Sacramento. It should be a piece of cake in Los Angeles, and there hasn't been a peep out of anybody about that. So I just raised that, put that on our collective radar screens, and we have a template historically going back just 40 years for that very thing.
Go for it.
Organized labor, they are in trouble in part because of the pending Supreme Court justice that's likely to wipe out public sector unions, right? Now, I know that shortly after November, there was a big reorganizing of what they would be doing in a post-Trump era. This is the LA County Federation of Labor. So I think labor realizes that this is a really precarious period, not only in terms of their existence, but also for Los Angeles. So they're starting to think out of the box. And so I would agree with you that this has to be a part of whatever out-of-the-box thinking they're doing, in part because of their survival, in part because of the changes in the city, and in part if they want to remain relevant in a very important issue that is labor and income and neighborhood involved, they have to be at that table, so to speak, on this issue.
All right. Are we good? Is there a final comment? Or we didn't actually get to address the NIMBY question. I don't know if, Cecilia, you have actually done this before. So
on the NIMBY question, I go back to leadership. Okay, so here's the thing. We're not talking about ceding, devolving all power to communities. We live in a representative democracy, not a direct democracy.
Right?
Which means that you actually have to have people that run on values and run on ideology. And it can't just, you know, just be pro-labor, I'll do whatever. You actually have to tackle these tough issues. So my answer to that is you need to have truly progressive elected officials that stand up to community members and say, you know what? We really need this housing here. Where are your kids going to live? Can your kids buy your house? Can your kids find an apartment? What was it like when you graduated from college? Were you able to get an apartment with your first job? When you break it down that way, you have to get people to empathize with each other. And it's hard work, man, and it's brutal when you deal with community members who just want to yell and scream at you because they want to protect. They're very, very afraid of losing the little that they have. But that's where leaders have to stand up, take a lot of blows, and hope that their values and the authenticity that they bring to the job will prevail. Because what people know is when you're just lying to them.
That's right.
People know when you're lying. People may respect you, they may disagree with you, but they'll respect you if you go into the belly of the beast and you have a genuine conversation around values. And I think that's the kind of leadership that we need to see more of. Zev, thank you for bringing in that history. You know, we forget about the history of rent control. Like, nobody mentions it anymore, right? And it was a different time, but I just want to say thank you for bringing in that history, and I'm so glad you're directing this program. Yes.
Thank you all for coming. Thanks to all these folks.
People forget that.
It's 5:20, according to my iPhone. I'd like to thank our panelists for a really stimulating afternoon. And there's a screening of the game in the bar. There's also a reception outside. Thank you very much for joining us.